5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. This is a recording with Commodore Frank B. Caldwell, C-A-L-D-W-E-L-L, Royal Canadian Navy, brackets retired, close the brackets, in Ottawa, 4 June 1982. That's the end of the heading. The text begins, "Thank you for coming, Frank. We decided in our talks yesterday and today before doing this tape that you would like to talk first of all about the venture and then perhaps the four anecdotes you have, and then we'll see how it goes from there. So you're on with venture."
Well, thank you. In starting off on the venture story, I would like to emphasize that the majority of this information is hearsay information. It is not actual information of which I was present when it happened. But I joined the venture in October of 38 and served in it until April 39 during our second West Indies cruise. Others who would have additional information or corroborative information might well be Rear Admiral K.F. Adams, who took delivery of the ship from the builders in 1937, Rear Admiral J.C. Hibbard, who was the first lieutenant in the first West Indies cruise, and Rear Admiral C.J. Dillon, who was a supply officer on the first West Indies cruise, and has written some sort of story in Crow's Nest on it.
Yes.
Also, Commodore O.C.S. Robertson, who was executive officer or first lieutenant in the second West Indies cruise. And I believe he has a model, a very nice model of the ocean. The story begins really with the London disarmament conferences about 1930. I think it was either the late 20s or 1930, which then I'm not certain whether it's commander or captain, P.W. Mellies, I'm not quite sure just which rank he held at that time, was the naval advisor to the Canadian delegation at the disarmament conference. And he met the Viscount Monsell, who was the first lord, not the first CEO, the first lord of the Admiralty. He was an ex-naval officer who was interested in reintroducing sail training into the Royal Navy.
Let me interject. How do you spell Monsell?
As far as I can recall, it's M-A-U-N-S-E-L-L. It's a title it's a family title over there. He had tried to get approval for this through the lordships of the Admiralty, but they had avoided going back into this type of training because they said that time was not available in the average career of a young officer. However, Nellies said that it was obvious that he was going to rise to the top of the Canadian naval picture, and that when he got in power, he would try and float it for an adventure, if you will.
Yes.
So this all came to pass in somewhere about the mid-30s. He took over from Walter Hose and started the ball rolling. And it was supposed to be a very modest training ship that they were going for. But when he got approval, the first thing they did, again I emphasize this is hearsay, but I think it's on record, they set out a civil service competition for the design of this ship. And what they got back out of this competition was something rather like a showboat type operation. I mean, first of all, the criteria for this ship, it had to be sail operated. There's lots of room for pulley hauling for the trainees. It was to be an ordinary seaman training ship. So we got our houseboat with three accommodation decks above the waterline and three little stub masts on top. Well, this obviously was not going to work in the North Atlantic. So people with a little bit better ideas on the subject rejected that particular design. And then someone in Halifax who knew, and this was, I think, Bully Pressey himself, yeah, knew Bill Rowe, the designer of yachts and bank schooners, the designer of the Blue Nose.
R-O-U-E.
R-O-U-E. And I don't think he bothers putting the...
Rowe, like John Rowe's
uncle.
John Rowe's uncle.
Yeah. So they approached Bill Rui, and Bill Rui said, well, you know, how much is the design fee? Because I'm pretty busy these days, and I've got a pretty good reputation to keep up. So anyway, they mentioned the design fee, which was, I suppose, ridiculous, probably about $1,000. He's just getting much more than that for doing a design. So he demurred to some degree, saying that this was not on. But these would-be friends of his prevailed upon him, and eventually he agreed to do something for a little bit more than the design fee, but still not up to his normal charge. And basically the way he put it, well, if that's all the money you're going to spend, that's all the design you're going to get. And he took a bank schooner design, and he cut it in two and lengthened it by 30 feet, and put three masts in instead of two, and the additional length was to provide greater accommodation between decks. And that's how Venture came to be born.
A Grand Bank schooner lengthened.
Yeah. And of course, one of the difficulties was that because everything was to be hydraulic, the big mainsail, the big driver, had to be cut down, and that's why the ship was never really well balanced for sail. Her mainsail was too small to give her the windward driving power that a bank schooner normally had. She sailed better out off the wind than I.
Yes, I could see.
So, anyway, now we come to the question that in due course, contract was let on the basis of the lowest bidder, plus a little bit of political patronage, I guess. And here I think we need to have a check done as to the substantiation of this. As I recall it, the builder was a man called Terrio. But anyway, the builder was in Metegan, Nova Scotia.
Spell it, please.
Metegan, M-E-T-E-G-H-A-N. He was experienced, as most people were in the mid-30s, experiencing financial difficulties. But this was he had obviously underbid his costs, but this was a bit of a godsend to keep him going, and he was in financial difficulties at the time. And of course, in a contract of this sort, you make your first payment on signing the contract, the second payment on the laying the keel, and then further payments on planking and decking and launch and things like that.
What was that last word?
Launch.
Oh, launch, yes, sorry.
So, sure enough.
And the last one when it floats.
We'll get on around to that. So anyway, there was no great overseeing organization in place in that time. And so he was given his first payment, and he promptly retired some of his outstanding debts. He asked for a second payment, so they paid him a second time around, and then he produced a nice new home for himself. He was a man of substance now. By this time, some rumors were floating back to Ottawa as to what was happening, and they were anxious to know what was happening to their ship. And Commander E. Davy, Cecil Davy, was told that he was in charge of the building project. So he began to find out a few things. First of all, there'd be no work done on the ship itself, except they'd laid a piece of wood down for the keel. So then he found that they were going in the woods and cutting trees and bringing them out green and putting them in as ribs and planking. And I can vouch for this because when I was served in 18 months, 2 years later, when the ship was working, we were in a hot climate, the sap was still boiling out of it. So eventually, make a long story short, she was running very late for completion, and eventually she was planked and decked and ready for launch. I have seen a picture, I don't know whether it's available in D. Hiss' shop, of her launch where she was pulled down the slip by one horse, one ox walking around a capstan with a connection of ropes and pulleys.
Yeah.
And I think that's rather an interesting thought, that that's how they managed in those days. So they put her in the water when the tide was high, and they took her over to the nearby jetty and tied her up and then decided to have a party. And big do was going on, and of course the tide went out, and she hadn't been securely tied, she fell over, and the next tide came in and filled her full of salt water. But they recovered from that one somehow or other. And as far as I recall, the next thing was the masts. He was supplying the masts. Well, he had followed an old custom down there that you, when you need a mast, you go around and find some schooner that's falling apart and lift the spars out of her and use them again, because often they have more life than the hull. So he did this, but of course, in each case, they were about 4 to 6 feet short of what they were intended to be. So one thing about the new naval overseeing function was they bowled this one out, and he managed to use one of his reclaimed spars as the foremost, but he had to go and order two new spars from BC, which was made him very unhappy, because this was added expense, which he had not thought of. The next thing I have note of here are the sails. He had subcontacted with a Yarmouth sail loft to make the sails for the ship, and then in due course they were ready as the ship was reaching completion. And they were delivered to the ship, plus one deputy sheriff, who, having delivered them on board, nailed a writ on the mast and said he was in charge of the assets of that firm until he got paid for the sails. So this left the RCN with a rather awkward picture of having a ship pretty well complete, like ready for sea, but in the hands of a deputy sheriff of Nova Scotia. So they got around this by forming a crew under now Admiral Adams, Ken Adams, swore him in as a deputy sheriff and put the crew on board. So we now had two deputy sheriffs, each of which had co-equal authority, so therefore Ken Adams took the ship to sea and with his newfound crew, and took around to Lunenburg, where they installed the diesel engine, the Petters diesel engine, which is a story in itself, anyway. And then, when that was all done, they moved on to Halifax. But it was quite obvious that, things were kind of awkward. You were sailing under the Red Ensign in a naval ship with two deputy sheriffs on board. So Ken Adams concocted his little routine. He explained to the other deputy sheriff that when they got to Halifax, the heads on board were closed and they had to use the facilities ashore. So he explained to him where the facilities were, and following the morning, the deputy sheriff went over to make his morning call, and they promptly whipped down the Red Ensign and put up the White Ensign and put an arm sentry on the prow, and that's how the Venture became HMCS Venture.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
She was originally fitted with 2 3-pounders on the forecastle, but they got so entangled with the head soles and the anchor work that they took them out. Anyway, she went along with a little bit of a bow trim as a result of the... So. But she originally had 2 3-pounders in there.
2 3-pounders?
Yep. I'm now sort of referring back to the time when I joined her in the end of September 38.
September 38, yes.
She'd already done one cruise down to the West Indies the previous year.
With Ken Adams in command?
No, I better explain the chain of command. Ken Adams only brought her to Halifax.
Yes.
Then A.R. Pressey, Lieutenant Commander A.R. Pressey, took command.
Yes.
Known as Bully Pressey or Starboard 10.
Starboard 10.
And, sorry. As far as I can recall, the officers for their first cruise south in 1937 were Lieutenant Commander Pressey in command, J.C. Hibbert, Lieutenant J.C. Hibbert as first lieutenant, Lieutenant A.F. Stanley, RCNR, as sailing master, because apparently there was a feeling that no RCN officer could handle anything under sail. Lieutenant C.J. Dillon is the supply officer, and I believe Sub-Lieutenant Dyer was in her for a short time, but it may only have been in passage.
Ken Dyer.
When we went off on our cruise, the second cruise, we left in the beginning of October, it was Commander G.M. Hibbert was in command, Lieutenant O.C.S. Robertson was RCNR, was first lieutenant, and myself as sub-lieutenant was, everything else. Chiefly navigating and training.
And the crew, how many?
The crew totaled 42, in our crews, of which about 24 were trainees, and the rest were ship's company. We also carried at that time, I meant to mention that while Bully Pressy was in command, he had a friend, Bear. His mascot was a bear, a proper brown bear or black bear. Yeah. And it was quite a big thing. And he carried with him a well-known RCM boxer come wrestler called Pal Clark. And he was bear keeper in chief, and he had to wrestle with the bear.
What's the first name of Clark?
Well, he was known as Pal.
P-A-L.
P-A-L, Pal Clark.
Pal Clark, yeah.
I think he was a stoker, but I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think the bear went overseas. I think he just stayed on board during the time in Canada. When we went off, we took a little a kid of the goat variety with us. I don't know why we did, but apparently. Now,
this is a wonderful story.
I think some of the odd little bits that. Our communications, we had one sparker set on a 500 KC emergency rescue wave. And we just listened in on 500, and if someone had something urgent, they'd try to raise us at that time. But we normally made arrangements for our mail to be sent. If we reached one port, we'd send a telegram back saying send the next mail to so and so port, because we didn't necessarily stay to any prescribed schedule of calls. Now, just stop for a moment while I check where I got to in my. As we left Halifax in October, we ran into some cold, stiff winds outside, so the rigging promptly froze, and we sailed southeast until we hit the Gulf Stream, and they thawed out again. And then we could tack ship.
You couldn't?
No. We were headed for Bermuda, and we got to Bermuda, I think it was 10 days later. We were people were kind of worried where we were, but we got there 10 days later. And after a due stop there, we went on to Barbados. But at Barbados, we ran into the other trouble, no wind at all. So it took us 12 days to get to Barbados. I think we got there on Christmas Eve. And by this time, there were people that were genuinely worried about us, and the lady boats were all on the lookout. For any wreckage of a schooner.
Yeah.
Then, for the rest of the cruise, we went through the Windward and Leeward Islands, getting as far south as Trinidad, and then working our way up again, and eventually rendezvoused with the RCN destroyers to transfer our ordinary seaman, Mark TR, to the destroyers and took on board a new batch of trainees. We were to have gone to Jamaica, but as we left St. Lucia, we found that the wind was against us, so the captain and I, who shared the night watch, captain had the first watch, I had the middle watch, and the first lieutenant had the morning watch. Lonely.
You stayed up with the captain because he was lonely, yes.
So anyway, when he turned over to me in the wardroom, and then I went up top to and in the course of this, we decided that it was going to be a hard slogging match over to Jamaica, so we'd go to Grenada instead. So we simply turned south and went. But unfortunately, I forgot to tell Robbie when he came on watch that we were headed in a different direction. I just said, the course is so-and-so, the wind is so-and-so, you're good for 4 hours of watch. So he suddenly decided we weren't headed for Jamaica, so he sent for me to find out what had happened. So this is one of the standing jokes of the ship. I think another little interesting thought about this cruise was that there had been no fare log submitted from the ship since the ship had been on during the time the ship had been on the first West Indies cruise. The rough log, the deck log, had been kept, but there'd be no fare log sent in to Ottawa. So one of the first interesting bits of information I got was that I was to forward the fare log for the past year or year and a half. So this was quite an interesting little adventure, because sometimes they hadn't bothered to put the weather in, and I had to invent the weather and a few incidents just to keep make sure that there was enough there to best to keep people's attention. But I think one of the funny things is you came across some rather unusual entries in the decalogue at that time. I don't know who's put them in, but including one, the fact that the sailing master had been placed in irons.
Oh.
He had come home slightly under the weather and decided he was going to tell someone off and told them off and was told. But I changed that into he was placed under close arrest.
But yes.
But apparently there was some risk. I don't know whether he was lashed down or what.
Because that bit of the log was before you had joined.
Before I joined.
Yeah.
And I became very good at forging initials and whatnot, various people who had preceded me. Anyway, our cruise was rather less exciting than that. We got back to Halifax in April, and I transferred back to Saguenay, from which I had originally joined the ship.
April what year?
April 39.
39, yeah.
The ship continued to cruise that summer along the eastern Atlantic coast on training voyages. But once war broke out, I think you will recall, she became an accommodation ship for the British at HMS Seabourn, and then it became the communications link up with the Narrows
for
the convoys coming out of the Bedford Basin. And eventually she was sold out of the service at the end of the war because they didn't feel there was enough life in her to continue in the service.
Presumably the sap had stopped running.
Well, she was never coppered, you see.
No.
And she ended her days she burnt to the water's edge in the Gulf of St. Lawrence in the ice, and I think she was sealing at that time. And she was used as a sort of coastal trader and sealing and any other odd job.
Was she ever paid for?
I don't know.
I mean, I know we paid the builder, but I wonder.
You mean, did she ever earn a keep?
Well, we gave money to the builder, and the builder paid his debts and built a house, I wonder.
Oh, well, no, I think eventually. I imagine she cost a lot more than originally contracted.
Give me a guess.
I have a feeling that the original... Now, this would have to be checked. I have a feeling that the original contract was for something less than $100,000. I think somewhere about $80,000. And I think by the time she was finished, she was well over $200,000. But many of those are sort of minuscule figures when you talk about shipbuilding.
Well, maybe the percentages are the same, but the total figures are higher today.
So that, I believe, is the story of the Gallant HMCS Venture, as far as I know it. She was certainly not a high-class sailor. I think the best speed we got out of her was off Barbados when we did about 13 knots with a quartering wind. And we were sort of encouraged along a little bit because we were racing a commercial schooner down there called, I think, the Flying Fox, something Fox, which was owned by an American called Kennedy. And he was a well-known figure in the West Indies in those days for inter-island trade. And,
yes.
He had a nice little iron wrought iron schooner built in Bath, I think, Bath, Maine.
Bath, England.
No,
not England, that's inland. Bath,
Maine.
Maine. Did she ever fire her three-pounders?
Well, they were out by the time I joined.
Oh, I see.
And I think she'd have stopped dead in her tracks if she ever had.
Well, if you'd pointed them aft, it would have increased her speed.
And taken half the ship with it. So, I wonder whether you've got any other points you wanted to
inquire
about that.
Some will occur to me when this comes, and we can make another tape at another time.
But you know the addresses of people like J.G. Hibbard.
I've got all those.
K.F. Adams.
Yes.
O.C.S. Robertson.
He's in Oakville.
Yeah.
Alec Douglas knows.
Yeah.
Will know all these.
Alf Stanley, after he was an RCNR who this particular episode went into the RCN during the war, and post-war he was served with some distinction in the cable ships, the Cyrus Field and the cable ships.
Yes. Well, that's very good for the historian, because if he wants to develop the story, he has a lot of other references. I myself will follow up with OCS Robertson, whom I've got to see anyway. He's my old captain.
Yeah, give him my best.
I'll give him your best.
I gather he's not been terribly well recently.
Well, he's not bad. He was away when I phoned him, but I was talking to his housekeeper, J.C. Hibbard, whom I see almost weekly.
Is it on?
Yeah, it's on.
It's Jumping Jimmy.
Yeah, the same, Jumping Jimmy. And the last one you mentioned, I don't know where he is, but Ken Adams is up island.
Yes.
And who's the fourth?
Well, Charles Dillon, you know.
And Charles Dillon, I'm on the phone to, we have lunch together periodically. So I'll follow it up with them. I'll get tapes from them on this story.
Yes.
And then with your tape, this will make it more complete for the naval historian to follow up should he wish to. Now, thank you for that bit on venture. You had an anecdote for me about San Salvador.
Well, no, it was not an anecdote that I'm aware, not that I'm built in on, but I just wondered whether you were aware of this particular incident.
Well,
you
perhaps
can get details from Alec Douglas himself, who has got it on record, and perhaps personal details from Nigel Berdur, whose father was there at the time.
Well, I'd forgotten the incident. Just tell me
really
what happened.
What it was about 1933, I think. The Canadian ships were going south for their winter cruise, and the British consul in San Salvador appealed to his home government for a ship to stand by because of the rioting and insurrections in San Salvador. And the nearest ship available was the Vancouver, which was the Admiral Berdur's, then Commander Berdur's ship.
Yeah.
And they put in to San Salvador to be on call in case they were required, and they did in fact land a platoon to protect the British residents in that area.
But
as soon as they landed the platoon, everything went quiet, they'd take the platoon back on board again, and then to be summoned again. So eventually, I gathered from the story that Commander Berdur got rather tired of this to and froing to the beach, and he decided he had to keep his itinerary and put all his men on board and went off. And there was no big shebang because the next day the U.S. Marines came in anyway.
That was the end of that civil disturbance. And you spoke to me now about your time in HMS Dragon.
Yes.
You, I think, what rank were you?
I was a midshipman then.
You were midshipman, and you were with Eric Boak and Pat Russell. And HMS Dragon's captain was Johnson, Captain Johnson, and you went into Bermuda in 1935, I've forgotten which ship.
Well, first of all, the Dragon was in refit in Bermuda, so that's why we were there.
Oh, I see, yes.
The ships that came in were two Canadian destroyers, of which I do not recall their names at this moment, because. But I do know that the senior officer was then Captain Berdur. As you recall, you come through a long entrance channel through Grassy Bay, and then. And we turned out the guard and band to do the honors to
you
this.
You pass Admiralty House to port, then you come up to Ireland Island.
Ireland Island, and through Grassy Bay, inside Ireland Island.
And into the dockyard.
Well, we had turned out the guard and the band to sort of pay the honors to the visiting ships, but the two destroyers came in with their local gramophone going full blast, anchors away, and they were quite busy enjoying the fact that they were entering harbor. So this one annoyed the captain that he thought destroyers should not be aping bigger ships.
Yes.
They should not be playing music on entering harbor. So he then led the captain, Berdur, then led his two-ship navy up into Hamilton Harbor.
Yes.
Under the shadow of the Admiral's flag, and then hoisted the senior officer present. Senior naval officer present.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know whether, in fact, the Admiral, who was in residence, took exception to this or not, but certainly our Captain Johnson did. He felt this was a sacrilege. And so he sent the Canadian Mitchell, and he said he didn't think much of the RCN, and he better make sure that we got a little better grounding in the Patterson Protocol and good manners. And
he sent for all three of you?
Well, he sent for me. I was a senior one. And
oh, yeah.
He passed the buck to all the rest. And he said that for the next week or so, we would have the honor of pulling the whaler a mile and a half around the Somerset Harbor in the morning to pick him up and bring him back. And since it was going to be quite an arduous task, he would allow one of the other midshipmen to go as coxswain. So we only had three on the oars and one on the rudder. And I must say, the others just turned out well, because every now and again the fifth one would appear and take another oar. But they had to be careful they didn't get caught by the captain when they were on the return trip, because otherwise they were in trouble too. However, I think it went on for about 4 days, and then eventually someone relented and we got stood down from that little ordeal.
I wonder if Commander Brodeur was ever... If it was ever mentioned to him, I don't suppose you know.
I wouldn't know, because...
Well, midshipman's pretty far down.
Yeah.
Well, that's good.
Now, the other point
Yes?
You're following up on that one?
No.
The other point I had was really sort of, was it worthwhile doing a little bit of a research on trying to demonstrate how things have changed over the years, to have someone research the story about...